Canada's got a year to figure out its position on prostitution.
As of now, it means complete decriminalization.
A court decision is leading to new policy on sex for money in Canada, and we'll hear about our own country's prostitution problems. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, the Women's Perspective. Canada has 1 year to figure out where it stands on the issue of prostitution. A recent Supreme Court decision there struck down laws that had been used by law enforcement as a deterrent. And the fact is that without them, prostitution is legal in Canada. It's forcing the country to look not only at the sex industry, but at social problems that contribute to prostitution. Journalist Sadia Ansari recently reported on the case for Women's E! News.
Just to start off, prostitution itself is not illegal in Canada, but there are, you know, three provisions in the books of the Criminal Code that essentially make it illegal. So the three laws, there's one against owning or operating a brothel. There's one that prohibits living off the avails of prostitution. And then the last one is communicating for the purposes of prostitution. So those three things make it very difficult for people in sex work to actually engage in it without fear of being arrested or harassed by police, for instance. So these three applicants, Carrie Jean Bedford, Amy Leibovich, and Valerie Scott, were either currently sex workers or formerly sex workers, brought this case to basically argue that these provisions don't allow them to do their job because they endanger their personal security. So essentially they were making a constitutional argument that their security of a person was being violated by these laws. The initial case was appealed twice and went all the way to the Supreme Court. And so just last month, the Supreme Court has had kind of the final word and has said that all three of these laws are going to be struck down because the Supreme Court found that they did, in fact, violate, you know, the security of sex workers. So practically, that security means, for instance, living off the avails would mean that a sex worker couldn't hire a security guard or a driver because that would be living off the avails, and then that essentially that person's work would be illegal. But they've also given the government 12 months to react, basically to say, if you're going to create new legislation, we're going to keep these laws on the books for the next 12 months, and now you have this time to create new laws, obviously not violating the spirit of the Supreme Court decision. So the reaction, of course, by the applicants, they're thrilled. They're worried about what's going to happen in the next year, what the federal government might legislate. And also they're worried about municipalities and what municipalities might do to curb the ability for sex workers to do their work safely. On the other hand, there's an entire contingent of feminist groups that are not entirely happy with this decision because as of now, it means complete decriminalization. I mean, we're waiting to see what's going to happen with the government, but in this case, they're very concerned because essentially they're concerned that decriminalization is going to empower traffickers and it's going to empower pimps and johns and it's going to continue to put women at the risk of violence. You know, it's going to continue to make it difficult for women to exit prostitution and without any laws, it might even continue for them to be difficult to make it for them to report any harm that they might experience, you know, as sex workers. So some women are not very happy about this. And one of the women I interviewed, her name is Jackie Lynn. So she's an exited prostitute. She is a Métis woman. She's also a social worker and an academic who has now studied prostitution extensively. And for her, the sticking point is she feels that a lot of people have said this, and there's no way to quantify it, but that, you know, the majority have basically been drowned out, that the majority of women's groups and the majority of women do not feel that prostitution is legitimate work, like a legitimate career choice that should be recognized as such. But at its core, it's exploitation. And at its core, there are many inequalities, whether they be, you know, gender or racial or economic, that really drive people to sex work. So in that sense, it shouldn't be recognized just as any other job is recognized.
So knowing that there is a conservative majority in the Canadian government, what do you expect the government's response to this ruling to be?
One of the women in the women's groups had commented that, you know, interestingly enough, that, you know, although this government has cut a lot of women's programming and funding for women's programming, on this issue, they might be aligned with many feminist groups. So essentially, the Minister of Justice, Peter McKay, has has made statements saying that, in particular, the government will be looking to legislate to reduce the harms that flow from prostitution. And what that means yet, we're not sure. In an interview with La Presse, he mentioned studying models such as the Nordic model, which is a model that many women's groups are advocating for, but right now we don't know what that looks like. The Nordic model essentially was implemented in Sweden and a number of other countries, and it criminalizes the men, so, you know, the pimps and the johns, and it decriminalizes the sex workers, because it assumes that the sex workers are in the situation for a particular reason and they shouldn't be penalized for it. It also assumes that all prostitution is violence against women. So what this means essentially is that the Nordic model also comes with social supports for women that are engaged in sex work. One of the things that's really become a hot button issue is the overrepresentation of Aboriginal women in prostitution. And that's the reality in Canada, and your research has shown that's the reality the world over. If you look at one of Canada's poorest neighborhoods, it's the Vancouver's downtown east side, and it's very much known for being an area that's, you know, that's crippled with poverty, has a lot of issues with addiction. There are lots of social services there as well. When you look at who's on the street, it's Aboriginal women, right? So those are the most vulnerable people in prostitution. So these are not the women that are going to be afforded, you know, the luxuries that this law might give some. So these are not the women who are going to be hiring security guards or drivers, right? These are women that are pretty much going to be in the same situation. And if the men are decriminalized, you know, in their view, it makes it even more difficult for these women to be able to report any violence or really have any guarantee of safety at all. So I think that's one of the sticking points, is that there are many types of sex work, and when you look at who's engaging in sex work and at what level, at the most vulnerable level, which is women on the street, Aboriginal women are overrepresented. So I think that's one of the issues that's really going to come up during this next year, is looking at, you know, who are, like, exactly kind of what you asked, like, who are sex workers, you know, what kind of work are they engaged in, and how will the law impact all these different groups?
Sadia Ansari is a freelance journalist based in Toronto and a frequent contributor to Women's E-News. Coming up, firsthand accounts of a subculture that preys on young girls. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% Archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1282. There is a difference between human trafficking and prostitution, but one frequently leads to the other. According to ProCon.org, a nonpartisan nonprofit, California leads the nation in arrests for prostitution. Texas, Florida, and Nevada are next. But you may be surprised to learn that Ohio, Tennessee, and Maryland made the top 10 too. Child prostitution goes on in America every day and every night, despite the efforts of federal, state, and local authorities. The FBI estimates 100,000 to 300,000 children are being exploited. Through part of a youth radio special investigation, Trafficked, we'll hear from two of them. The girls we'll call Darlene and Brittany are originally from Oakland, California. 19-year-old Brittany and 18-year-old Darlene shared their stories with Youth Radio's Denise Tejada.
Darlene and Brittany were in middle school when Oakland was named one of the hotspots for child prostitution. As they entered their teens, classmates talked about boyfriends who had lots of money, and like most kids in the Bay Area, they listened to music by Oakland rappers whose lyrics about pimping glamorized the game.
A lot of it is glorified. Yeah. Oh, you're from Oakland, everybody has dreads, everybody goes dumb, we pop pills,
smoke a lot of weed,
parties, sideshows, and hoes.
If you're not part of the scene, it's hard to believe the prostitution has become normal for so many girls in Oakland and in other cities. But it's true. Girls see it as an escape from desperate home lives. No food on the table, absent parents, and friends getting shot. And pimps take advantage of that. Darlene and Brittany escape the world of sex trafficking, but they still see it everywhere.
I would see Johns that I used to date working in the Apple stores, or I can be going out to eat with my family and be on the freeway and look on MacArthur and at all the hotel rooms and be like, I used to be in those hotel rooms with Johns and Tricks. Is it like that for you?
It's really funny that you mentioned that, because me and my friend went to this Mexican spot right on 46, like right behind the bus stop. You know how some girls consider certain streets their corner. So that was like my corner. I'm like, wow.
Oakland police say most teenage girls get into prostitution the way Darlene did, through a boyfriend they trust, who turns out to be a pimp. They call them Romeo pimps, because they can sweet talk a girl into anything. When it comes to pimping hoes, I've been truly educated because I'm so slick. I make hoes turn tricks. Players University, class of 86. Darlene moved in with her 18-year-old boyfriend after her mother's boyfriend kicked her out of the house.
Then, like, on my 15th birthday, he was like, well, you know, since you're going to be staying with me and stuff, we need more food. We need to find a way to get some money. And he's the one that, like, introduced me to prostitution. And I didn't see anything wrong with it.
Once a girl is working for a so-called Romeo pimp, it's all business.
This is how you look at the guys. This is what you tell them. This is what cars to stay away from. This is how much you charge. And he just said it to me like that.
There's another kind of pimp, the gorilla pimp, the kind that uses force and fear to get his way. Oakland police estimate a third of teenage girls working in prostitution were abducted and forced onto the streets. Brittany was one of them.
I had got kidnapped when I was 15. I decided to cut school one day. I was in Oakland on Havens Court and Foothill, and all I heard was, man, go get that girl. And one of them came out and dragged me by my hair and pulled me into the car.
Brittany says she was gang raped by at least six men. She was put on the street in Sacramento by one of them, a 32-year-old who became her pimp. He took her phone, told her not to talk to anyone but Johns, and had his sister watch her so she wouldn't run. She was shuttled back and forth to work Oakland's red light district. Oh, yeah, this young beat a weeder. F*** them, don't feed them, I don't love them, I don't need them. I just stuff them in a beamer, take them to the track and leave them. International Boulevard is what prostitutes, pimps, and police call the track. It's where men come to buy sex.
It's around 6:10, and we are driving down International. And these are girls that look so much younger than I am, and I'm only 21.
In a 50-block span, I count 20 girls. Some are posted on street corners. Others are hanging by bus stops or just walking the same blocks over and over. No cilantro, no cebolla. I park at one of the many taco trucks on International Boulevard. The guys who work the truck say every day pimps use their parking lot to drop off girls and hang out. They say it's common to see a girl being beaten by her pimp. Basically, pimps run their businesses from this spot.
Just in a matter of seconds, there's a girl that's getting picked up by a guy or John.
From my car, I spot two women. One seems to be the leader, or what people in the game call a bottom girl. She approaches the car, speaks to the driver, and instructs the younger girl to walk over. This is what happened with Brittany and Darlene countless times.
It's a Toyota Prius. It's parked behind us, and they are waiting for a girl to get in the car. She has tight leggings, gray shirt. She's carrying her heels. She looks like she could be 17 or something. And they just left right now.
While most Oakland residents drive by and don't think twice about what's going on here, the people in this neighborhood do. People like 20-year-old Frank Pardo, whose mom owns Yoyi's Bridal Shop on 39th and International. Pardo grew up here.
They're always there. You always see them, and some of them are quite beautiful, too, looking like straight models. They've been here for all these years. What makes you think they're going anywhere? Police see them. I mean, everybody sees them. Nobody does anything.
Just on the street, there's a teenage girl in a short red dress crying on a bench. She's bleeding from her mouth. A business owner who runs a clothing store says he saw the whole thing.
One of them punched her right in her face, and so she went down, and then they went after her purse.
He says the man who punched the girl appeared to be her pimp. The store owner would not identify himself by name for fear of retribution from sex traffickers, which is the same reason he gave for not calling the police. At 15 years old, Brittany and Darlene were out on Oakland's track. They were also marketed on Craigslist before the adult services section was shut down and on other internet sites.
So make that money, bitch. Sell it to the world and let's get rich. Yep, or I could put you on Craigslist.
Brittany says her pimp got her hooked on drugs to keep her working around the clock. Usually, she ate only one meal a day.
You know, and that was like from Burger King or McDonald's, so that doesn't really even count.
It's not the best deal to have sex with 15 different guys in one day and only get a cheeseburger at the end of it.
Alameda County Assistant District Attorney Charmaine Bach compares the girl's situation to being brainwashed by a cult.
Remember Guyana and Jim Jones, where everyone's drinking that Kool-Aid drink? Well, that's exactly what these girls have had. Let's call it pimp juice. They've all had it, and they can't see past either their affection for him or their fear for their trafficker.
According to a recent survey by the FBI, 61% of teen prostitutes were raped as children. That's what happened to Brittany. She says she was raped by her stepfather and years later by her trafficker.
I went back to all those times just for the simple fact that I knew what he was capable of. He'd beat me and he'd rape me, he'd beat me and he'd rape me. And I just kept going back up until I ended up being pregnant by him, and he beat me so bad that I ended up having a miscarriage.
Finally, Brittany and Darlene had had enough. Darlene.
I got shot at quite a few times, and it's crazy. Before, I used to be fantasized with boys that are gangsters and stuff. Oh, they get heck of money, and they're just gangster, and it's cute and cool. That's okay when you're in, like, high school. After that, what are you going to do with your life? You're going to be in jail, or you're going to be dead. And I don't want part of either one of those.
Darlene says eventually she got tired of being arrested and wanted to go home. After her last arrest, she joined a program that transitions girls off the streets. Brittany got out, too, shortly after she had the miscarriage.
Then, 6 days later, it was a Sunday, and he put me on East 14th. I told him that I didn't want to be out on Sundays because I had a bad feeling about Sundays. And I seen my aunt, and my aunt ended up snatching me up and putting me in the car. And then she took me to my mom's house. 2 days later, I believe, police came knocking on my door saying I had a warrant.
That warrant put Brittany back in jail for prostitution. And like Darlene, she enrolled in a community program.
Since then, I've got back in school, and I graduated high school with, like, 20 extra credits. I'm starting college. I have two jobs now. Before, when I was, like, 15, I didn't see myself alive at the age of 18. And now that I am 18 and I can look back and say, you know, I've been through all of that and I've came out of it, it feels wonderful.
It's been about a year since Brittany and Darlene turned their lives around. It's still a work in progress.
I haven't worn heels at all, except if it was to prom.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't worn heels to my cousin's wedding. I wore flats, my mom's funeral. I'm scared to, like, wear heels again. I don't dress up at all because I'm like, man, if I go get dressed up, maybe somebody's going to think I'm a hoe. If I go get dressed up, like, how are people going to look at me and stuff?
Right. Like, I still feel that way when I'm wearing heels. I'm like, gosh, I hope I don't have that walk that I used to have when I wear heels. But then again, it's the whole healing process, you know, because you yourself and I myself are still healing off of it. And I'm sure you'll feel good when you dress up because you'll know that that's not you anymore. And that's how I felt when I wore heels on my 18th birthday. I felt like empowered in a way because I'm like, wow, you know, I'm not wearing heels because somebody's telling me to. I'm wearing them because I want to.
Both Darlene and Brittany are now working with community organizations to help other girls escape sex trafficking. They consider themselves survivors, navigating a new life. For NPR News, I'm Denise Tejada.
That story comes to us courtesy of Youth Radio. If you want to hear more from this award-winning two-part series, Google Youth Radio Trafficked and look for part two. And finally, a preview of next week's chat with artist Carolee Schneeman. She's been called an American treasure. A film about her life has been having its U.S. theatrical premiere in New York City this past week. It's called Breaking the Frame, a film by Marielle Nidoslavska with Carolee Schneeman. It's a project that is obviously close to the heart of an artist who has worked her entire lifetime to explore the edges of art and go beyond them.
I had utter trust and confidence and excitement and uncertainty for what she was going to do. Marielle Nidoslavska is a well-known filmmaker and a feminist based in Montreal. It was just an instant affinity, and it developed over 6 years where she would come here. Once she determined she's going to make this full complex film, she would come here and, oh, she'd look through my diaries and I would just say, whatever you need to look at, look through my photographs. She followed me sometimes with a crew to other exhibits of my work. The film has an extraordinary section on the opening of the pioneering feminist exhibit called WAC at the Los Angeles Museum of Contemporary Art. It opened, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago. And it was an international exhibit, and women, significant artists, had come from all over. It was just astonishing, and Mario was there. So part of the film that's centered on my life in art has this great community section,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, with the different women speaking about their experience and greeting each other and finding each other as friends after many years, all in this one celebratory exhibit.
Mm-hmm. And I know you've said you're very happy with how the film came out.
Oh, yeah, I'm still dazzled. Yeah, it's quite an experience for me.
That's artist Carolee Schneeman talking about Breaking the Frame, a film by Marielle Nidoslavska. Find out more at breakingtheframe.com. We'll have more of my conversation with Carolee Schneeman next week. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.